I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, health insurance for kids. The state-run federal program is in jeopardy. And separately, there are questions about dental care. Why did a 12-year-old Maryland boy recently die from essentially an untreated cavity? But first, returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan still face long waits for treatment and disability payments, despite a 7-month-old pledge from the Bush administration to fix the system. That's according to a new government accountability report out today. Last February, a Washington Post series about shoddy care at Walter Reed Army Medical Center sparked outrage and promises. Today, the GAO presented its report card to Congress. Democratic Representative Henry Waxman expressed lawmakers' concern that the problem isn't being fixed quicker.
I continue to be frustrated with the pace of improvement, and I worry that after 5 years of war, our military health care system is overstretched, with bigger problems coming down the line as soldiers are forced to serve more and longer deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mark Benjamin is national correspondent for Slate.com. He joins us. Mark, the GAO said that the Army still doesn't have clear answers to some of the worst problems affecting veterans' health care. What are those problems?
Well, first, Robin, I'm actually at Flan, but thank you.
Oh, sorry, typo there. Sorry.
No problem. What the biggest problem here has to do with the bureaucracy that these soldiers face. I mean, in other words, they're having trouble getting their appointments done. They're having trouble getting compensation for their wounds. And what is happening is soldiers are being held at facilities like Walter Reed and at other hospitals around the country, military hospitals around the country, for months and in some cases years waiting to get these issues worked out. It's very complicated and it's very broken.
Well, the GAO seemed to also single out warrior transition units, which were supposed to be a solution, now a cause for concern. What are they? What's the problem?
What is happening is that because the bureaucracy is so complicated, and we're talking about both in terms of getting care and in terms of getting compensation from the government, they've put together these teams. It's basically a doctor, a nurse, and a squad leader that are supposed to help these soldiers get through this complicated bureaucracy, everything from paperwork, filling out paperwork, to getting to the correct appointments. One of the problems is that they just are understaffed. I mean, they just only 17 of 32 of these teams had even 50% of their staffing up as of today. So, you know, it's obviously either not enough of a priority for the Army or they're just struggling to get it done.
Well, the report also focused on disability payments, as you said. And as the report says, there have been 8 congressional committees, a presidential task force, a presidential commission, the Pentagon and the VA both having investigations. But the system for rating of veterans' disability is still up in the air. Why is this rating system important? You know, how does it work?
Incredibly important if you talk to a soldier who's back from Iraq or Afghanistan. The way it works is when you're in the Army and you're too hurt to stay in the Army, the Army is supposed to make a determination of what kind of disability payments you should get for the rest of your life. Many, many soldiers find that system to be confrontational and arguably unfair. Once they get out of the Army, then they can try to take a separate bite of the apple and go to a separate department, the Department of Veterans Affairs, to go through the same system essentially again run by the Department of Veterans Affairs. So there are two problems. First, the Army system, a lot of soldiers believe, is very unfair and they don't get fair compensation. And then they sometimes have to wait years for the VA to make a decision about whether soldiers should get compensation from that organization. And that's how soldiers end up on the streets. You get a bad decision from the Army and you're waiting for years for the VA and you got to make your house payment.
Well, and by the way, and I'm not sure if this even came up, but we're wondering if this report dealt with the most stunning charge we heard, that injured troops are being told that they have pre-existing conditions that have led to, in at least one reported case, let's say a head injury from shrapnel, and that pre-existing condition denies them benefits. Joshua Kors reported about this and then testified before Congress. Did it raise that issue of pre-existing conditions barring benefits?
It didn't raise the issue of pre-existing conditions, but it did raise a similar issue, which is about traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, which are the two invisible injuries that are sort of hallmarks of this war. One is, you know, basically shell shock, and the other is when your head gets jerked around basically from a nearby explosion and you have brain damage, essentially. And what this report says is that the Army is still just not doing a good job of going out, screening soldiers, figuring out who's suffering from these injuries and treating them, and lots of soldiers are simply falling through the cracks without proper treatment, without proper screening, and without proper compensation for those wounds.
You know, one of the things the lawmakers were saying today seemed to be, you know, they can put together books to fight insurgents, all sorts of other things that the military has done in a hurry, but not this. Just in the couple seconds we have, there's going to be a lot of, I would imagine, reaction to this.
Well, you know, two things are happening here. One is that this problem is huge and very, very serious and very, very complicated. The other is that it's obviously clear that this is not a you know, a huge agenda item either for the Bush administration or for the bureaucracy at the Pentagon.
Well, Mark Benjamin, we'll leave it at that for today. Mark, national correspondent for Salon.com, speaking about the GAO report today that says veteran health care still very much in need of repair. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Staying with health care, last night the House passed a reauthorization of the SCHIP. That's the state children's health insurance program. And the Senate is expected to vote tomorrow. But the president has promised to veto the new bill, and the old expires Friday. So what happens now? The president and opponents of the bill say it increases spending, makes it possible for kids who aren't poor to move from private insurance to Medicaid. Some Southern lawmakers balk at the 61-cent per pack increase in the cigarette tax that will pay for the bill. And all opponents say it's a backdoor to socialized national health care. But the backers say it will insure people who were previously uninsured, and even lower middle-class families are struggling to buy insurance. Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us from Capitol Hill. Gail, this SCHIP program was supposed to supplement Medicaid. It's a state-run program. That's the S, what the S stands for. Tell us more.
It's a state-run program that has federal support for children who are low-income but not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. So it's trying to fill in that gap in the middle.
Because their family also isn't wealthy enough, it is said by backers,
to
pay for private insurance. Well, one thing we feel has been left out a lot of the debate are these income levels. Who exactly qualifies for the SCHIP program, and what are the income levels?
Each state can, of course, determine their own program. There are some states that are going for two times the poverty level, which for a family of three would be about $34,340. Anyone that's tried to buy private insurance and own a house at the same time might realize that's a stretch. Three times poverty level would be about $51,500 for a family of three. Now, the president, almost every time he talks about this, makes reference to $83,000 income level. At that point, a lot of people go, you know, ding, 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 ding. You know, it sounds like a very wealthy person. It might not be a wealthy person in New York, which is where the request came.
Yeah, let's back up. The states have to ask the federal government, you know, where they can set the level. This bill would say that they could do it, what, two or three times higher than poverty?
That's right.
And New York State did ask for whatever that would be, four times, I guess, the poverty level,
$80,000. And it was turned down.
Right. But people in Manhattan would say that wouldn't even cover housing.
That's it. You know, there is a lot that's going on right now in Congress that deals with just that sort of issue, the alternative minimum tax, which is beginning to hit middle class people in high cost areas like New York, Connecticut, and so forth. So this is a big part of what Democrats are trying to do, which is address the needs of those people as well. But what we're falling into here is a public perception that what this is a program for rich people. And in part that started because the Bush administration allowed states a lot of flexibility in terms of how they interpret that program. That's part of the conservative ideology that the federal government should not dictate. But on the other hand, a lot of states took that very far in terms of, for example, funding adults as well as children. And now part of the conservative argument is this is supposed to be a program for children. Why are we funding adults? Well, it was the Bush administration that allowed that because there were states that wanted to do it that way.
So there are a few adults under the program, but it's largely kids. And just again, to be perfectly clear, Gail Chadwick, what does the bill passed by the House say about how far above the poverty level states can go, and therefore how many perhaps new kids can be enrolled?
Their target is 10 million new children to be enrolled. Now, it's not clear that all of those 10 million are currently uninsured. That's another debating point. The president is saying that many of those children have private insurance, and the bill is just going to encourage them to shift to a government program.
Is that true?
It is. Both sides agree to that, but they don't know the numbers for sure. Another point that both sides are raising is that there are many poor children who would qualify under the current rules who are not currently enrolled. Republicans are saying, look, go after those children first before you expand the program to higher income children. It's a very interesting debate because, you know, part of the argument is that if you insure adults, that makes it much more likely that children will be taken to the doctor as well.
Well, let's stay with some of the practical questions that the president has promised to veto if the program ends on Friday. We understand that some states will have sort of a buffer because the SCHIP money is given out every 3 years, and some states still have some of that money in their coffers, but other states don't. What happens if they don't have any buffer in their coffers?
I think the most likely thing that's going to happen is that there will be a vote to extend the law for 3 months. That's something that Senator Chuck Grassley is calling. If the law simply expires, then I think there's enough money to redistribute among states for about 18 days. So it's not clear that on October 2nd, a poor family will wake up and find that they have no more health insurance.
Gail, why would the president do this, in that the Democrats seem to be making some political hay out of it? President Bush is asking for $200 billion for the war this week, the war itself costing billions a week, and then vetoing what would be a mere $35 billion a year for health care for kids.
Well, this, as you point out, is an excruciating vote for Republicans. Democrats are already talking about the fact that this vote is going to play very prominently in the next election campaign, which is why I think you saw so many Republican moderates, 41 of them, switch votes and support the bill in the House. For the president, there are two aspects. One, it's a way to say to the conservative base, I'm going to use the veto to draw the line on excessive spending. Now, you could say picking poor children is a very poor choice, but that's how they see it. The Congress is entering a whole period of appropriating. The president has threatened vetoes on most of the pending appropriation bills, and Republicans really hope he will use it. They want to send a signal to the base that we are fiscally conservative after all. But more importantly, I think, or at least as importantly, Hillary Clinton raised her own health plan. And that has put this squarely back into national politics. Where will the Democratic Party take health care? Will they move to some form of, as the president puts it, socialized medicine, where the initiative's taken away from patients and their doctors, is how he puts it. This is a big issue for the conservative base. Health care, Hillary Clinton, you can galvanize people around that issue as well. The president would rather see health care issues dealt with through the tax code. Now, the Republicans on Capitol Hill feel that he could not have picked a more painful first test of this theory. Senator Grassley has said publicly that he feels that if he were a Democrat, he would run just on this issue, that Republicans need to find an answer that the public can understand beyond something that sounds as arcane as preferring to go through the tax code, when the soundbite come next November could simply be Republicans voted against health care for poor children.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, we're also hearing today that all the Medicaid coverage in the world won't matter if a child can't find a doctor who will take Medicaid, or a dentist. Did a child in Maryland die because of flaws in the Medicaid system? We're going to take that on next. Later in the program, will the Walloons and the Flemish get a divorce? And remind us again, who are the Walloons? Back in a minute, here and now. Dentists in Maryland say they've been flooded with phone calls after a 12-year-old boy died because of untreated tooth decay. Her critics say his mom didn't do enough to help him, but DeMont Driver's mother says through a series of mistakes, hers and the system's, her Medicaid lapsed, and even under the supplemental state plan, she had trouble finding a dentist. Her son's death has added some urgency to the debate about a measure in Maryland that would set aside an extra $2 million a year to expand public dental clinics in poor areas. But it's also put a spotlight on the importance of dental care and problems of the poor in getting it. Richard Niederman runs a school-based tooth decay prevention program from the nonprofit Forsyth Institute here in the Boston area. They provide dental care to underserved kids. He joins us. And Dr. Niederman, DeMont Driver's molar infection went to his brain. Is this an isolated incident?
In this case, it was an isolated incident, but it is a definite challenge. It can occur anytime, anywhere. I think the issue is most of us think of a cavity as a hole in a tooth, when in fact it's an infection in a tooth. And an infection, as you know, anywhere in the body can move to any other location in the body.
And in his case, it went to his brain. He did ultimately end up in the hospital, but at that point it was too late. And as we said, he died.
It's a tragedy.
Well, I mean, how many kids, You say it's isolated that someone might die, but how many kids get that far where they're actually sick because of their teeth?
In a national state survey in Massachusetts, I think the estimate was that about 10% of third graders have acute abscesses, infections that are draining and cause problems for them and that are unrecognized by their parents or the schools.
Well, what are the problems as you see them? DeMont's mom said that she couldn't find a dentist who would take her child. Now, we understand that finding a dentist who accepts Medicaid can be tough. In Maryland, where this little boy lived, about 900 of the state's 5,500 dentists accept Medicaid. But a recent study in Connecticut found that only about 100 dentists in Connecticut out of more than 2,000 accept Medicaid. It seems to be, it is the problem.
It is, in fact. In Massachusetts, I think it's about 10% of the dentists take Medicaid. And it's not just a matter of who takes Medicaid, but where they're located. In Boston, some of the practices, the community health centers that take Medicaid have closed their practices because they just can't handle the patient loads.
That would be one problem. Why else would a doctor not accept Medicaid?
The fees are considerably lower than what it costs the dentist to provide care. The burden of joining Medicaid, for one, and then filing forms and getting compensated is another. And, you know, there's efforts currently going on in the state to rectify those problems, but they aren't solved yet.
Well, and there seems to be an additional problem. The American Dental Association says that nationally, the no-show rate is 24% for Medicaid patients, only 14% for privately insured patients. So they say they lose thousands of dollars a year because Medicaid patients book the time, which is lost, and then don't show up.
That's another issue. I think there's cultural and social barriers that enter into the equation that make it difficult for people to manage each other's lives or to assist one another.
Right. And again, in DeMont Driver's case, the little boy who died, his mother said that some of those cultural problems were they were poor, so they had no transportation. They were homeless at times, erratic telephone and mail service. They didn't get the paperwork that Medicaid sent them at one point because it went to an address they were no longer at. So it's hard, it sounds like, for poorer kids to have routine exams. How are you trying to, you know, fill in that gap?
What we're attempting to do is overcome a number of barriers by taking care to kids in elementary schools. So we provide comprehensive prevention in school to kids. It takes us perhaps 5, maybe 10 minutes to do a comprehensive dental exam, and that's followed up by comprehensive prevention by hygienists.
So this is a completely different approach, bringing the dental care to where the kids are.
What we found is one round of prevention can reduce the occurrence of new cavities by 50%. Two rounds of prevention reduces it another 50%. So by three rounds of prevention, we've almost eliminated all new decay.
You know, what do you think about the current debate about, you know, adding more money into the programs? We just spoke of the SCHIP program, which is a supplemental program to Medicaid for kids who are, you know, poor but not poor enough for Medicaid. You know, what do you think of that, of adding more money? Is it that or is it changing the technique?
I think you need more than two different approaches. You need a top-down approach, which is what SCHIP is, and you need a bottom-up approach, which is what we're doing. There isn't a one solution to this problem of providing outstanding health care to all Americans. The SCHIP program and what we're doing are two different mechanisms to approach the same end.
And by the way, who funds your program through the Forsyth Institute?
The program is funded through foundation support and private donations.
Well, and some people would say, you know, that certainly can't be the model across the country.
That was how it got started. Now we're reimbursed by Medicaid. So the SCHIP program does provide funding support ultimately to Medicaid, but it doesn't mandate or determine how care is delivered. It just makes dollars available. Clinicians still need to be creative about how they can solve problems for their community.
Perhaps taking your approach. By the way, we just want to note that people are saying that a routine tooth extraction might have saved DeMont Driver's life, and it would have cost about $80.
Exactly. It's a tragedy. I can't think of any other word.
Richard Niederman runs the school-based tooth decay prevention program for the Forsyth Institute in the Boston area. As he said, that's a nonprofit, but now the tooth decay prevention program at schools is funded by Medicaid.
It's initiated by foundation support. So that's the seed funding.
Yeah.
Once we're up and running, then we bill Medicaid for our services or private insurance companies. So this is not an issue just for poor kids. We feel that prevention works for folks from Beverly Hills to Watts, from Roxbury to Beacon Hill. It's everybody prevent it because we're dealing with an infection.
So even private insurers should consider this, you know, funding a program like yours that goes directly to the schools and the kids.
That's my feeling, yes. I think that kids are much better served with prevention than waiting for things to go wrong.
Or waiting for harried parents to get them to the dentist. Dr. Needleman, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you for calling.
Okay, still ahead today, Cheetah on creating Anita 50 years after the birth of West Side Story. That's after the news, here and now. The European Union was meant to bring Europe together, but has it actually made it easier for countries to break apart? Belgium has long been split between the Dutch-speaking Flemish, who make up Belgium's north, and the French-speaking Walloons in the south. But lately, as International Newsweek puts it, they're down to sleeping in separate beds. 10.4 million people call themselves citizens of Belgium. For the past 100 days or so, they've been without a government, largely because the country is so evenly divided along linguistic and cultural lines. And now some are calling for a divorce. John Peet is Europe editor for the Economist magazine, and he joins us on the line from London. John, welcome.
Hello.
And, you know, it's probably embarrassing, but for many Americans, they weren't even aware of a split in Belgium until Justine Henin and Kim Clijsters played each other in professional tennis, and we learned that they each spoke a different language. They are sort of the face of the split in some way?
Well, to some extent. I mean, Belgium is not a place that gets a lot of headlines, although Brussels is recognized as the capital of the European Union as well as the capital of Belgium. But the divide between the Flemish and the French-speaking Walloons has been getting steadily worse over the past two or three decades. And that's creating a lot of political tensions, which, as you say, can even be seen on the tennis court.
Well, how would you characterize each part? Here in the U.S., we could say that Californians are laid back and New Yorkers fast-paced. But how are the two different groups in Belgium characterized?
Well, the Flemish North is harder working, a bit more right-wing, more conservative, and doesn't believe in state aid. The French-speaking South is much more what an American might regard as socialistic. They believe that the state should provide. They have higher rates of unemployment, and they look to the state to provide jobs. And so there's a big difference of philosophy in the two parts of the country.
Well, we've read also that Wallonia was Belgium's industrial belt. Its population was older, unemployment is high, so it's not as much they believe in socialism, but there's more of a necessity. While in Flanders, the population is younger, there's more high-tech, more business.
I think that's right. I mean, the story of Belgium can be seen in some other countries. I mean, not in the way that you have this political pressure for a possible division. But in many cases, including in Britain and even in France and some other parts of Europe, and to some extent in the United States, the old parts that industrialized first became very rich. So you saw at the end of the 19th century that the area of coal and steel around southern Belgium was the rich part of the country, and that meant that the French-speaking elite were the rich people, while the Flemings were mostly in agriculture and they were poor. But what's happened is that being big in coal, steel, and traditional industries is not a good thing these days. And those areas, as you've seen in so many other wealthy countries, have now become the poor parts, whereas the lightly industrialized, more service-oriented north of Belgium has become the rich part of the country. And this switch is one of the big reasons why there's such a tension between the two sides of the country.
Well, so can we guess that it's the richer part that may be leading the move for divorce?
You can indeed. As you see in some other countries, Catalonia and Spain is another example, and northern Italy is a third example. Rich regions dislike having to transfer large sums of money to poor regions, especially when they think the poor regions are feckless and waste that money and are not hard working. And some of what we're seeing here is precisely that tension.
Well, and we read that the Flemish consider the Walloons a ball and chain. Now, we rush to say. We're making, you know, we're speaking in broad brush strokes here, but that's pretty much the sentiment.
Yes, it is, among some Flemings.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this tension is not about everybody, and generally, opinion polls suggest that most Belgians would like to find a way of keeping the country together. But there is definitely a feeling in Belgium, which you also see in some other countries in Europe, that rich regions don't want to just pour money into poor regions without poor regions making an effort. And this pressure can be seen in Italy and to some extent in Spain, and even in Britain, where the English are fed up with pouring money into Scotland.
Well, and what would be the result in Belgium? I mean, would Walloon become a part of France?
I think this is where we're getting into the realms of slightly more fanciful imagination. I mean, it remains unlikely that Belgium will split apart, just as it's unlikely that Quebec will leave Canada. It's not an impossible outcome. But when you start to look at the nitty-gritty of how it would work, what would happen to the capital, what would happen to the public debt, engineering a divorce is actually very tricky. What we and others have been pointing out in the past 3 months is that the longer it takes, the more it encourages the notion that maybe we should look more seriously at whether the country could divide up.
Well, and by the way, what is the problem with the government? Why has there been no government for 100 days?
The way Belgian politics works is not very helpful to the country because each community has its own party. So there is not a Belgian Socialist Party. There is a French-speaking Socialist Party and a Flemish-speaking Socialist Party, and similarly with the centre-right and the Liberals. So you have a mishmash of about 7 or 8 parties, and each of them is only representing their half of the country. To form a government, they need to form a coalition, and that this time round, and sometimes previously, has proved extremely difficult because the leader of the biggest Flemish-speaking party has said he thinks Belgium is a historic relic and maybe we should think about breaking it up.
Well, and you mentioned other countries, and The Economist and others have written that it's the very fact that the European Union was constructed that's made it easier for countries to break up. Why is that? What's that thinking?
It is a bit of an irony about the European Union, which brings together 27 countries under a sort of an embryo super state, that if you are in the European Union, it gives you a shelter and it makes it easier, for example, for Scotland to think about whether it should split off, or Catalonia and the Basque Country in Spain, or in this case, Flanders and Wallonia, because everywhere is still within the European framework. It seems safer for a small country to feel that maybe they could exist within that organization.
John Peet, Europe editor for The Economist magazine, speaking to us from London. And just, you know, this is potentially serious, but we understand it's been the butt of quite a few jokes. I mean, how are people viewing this in Europe?
I think generally they regard it as at the moment as a bit of a joke, because it has been long known that Belgium has tensions. It's long been known that it takes a long time to form a government. And people have said Belgium is a slightly artificial construct, although actually it's an older country than either Germany or Italy, for example. But just because it's a joke doesn't mean that people aren't occasionally thinking of it more seriously. And we did see, for example, Czechoslovakia split up in the early 1990s, and we have seen Montenegro split off from Serbia. These things can happen within Europe. And to some extent, what the international press is doing by talking about this is bringing home to the Belgian politicians that if they don't get their act together, the pressures for a divorce will only increase.
Bringing it back to where we started, which half would get Justine Henin?
Well, you know, I mean, presumably she would go with Wallonia and the other one would go with Flanders. But, I mean, actually, Belgium does exist in symbolic terms as much as anything else. And people are very proud of their tennis players, Kim Clijsters and Justine Henin. And they're proud of the king. And that those are the sort of glue that holds the country together, which may be strong enough to continue to do so.
John Peet again from The Economist. Thanks so much.
That's fine.
And by the way, John said that many Brits are tired of pouring money into Scotland. I probably should have said, as we've reported here, that many Scots would very much like to break away from Britain. So there. Before we go today, the scraps of paper we leave behind, made public by the folks at Found Magazine. You're listening to Here and Now. 50 years ago tonight, the musical West Side Story opened at the Winter Garden Theater in New York City and received the first of many thunderous ovations. Now the Library of Congress is paying tribute with a new exhibit, West Side Story, Birth of a Classic. Opening night telegrams, notes from choreographer Jerome Robbins and composer Leonard Bernstein's annotated copy of Romeo and Juliet, on which the musical is based. West Side Story moved the star-crossed lovers to New York City and replaced the Montagues and the Capulets with the Jets and the Sharks, rival gangs of turf-protecting New York teens and recent immigrant Puerto Ricans. Tony, a former Jet, falls in love with Maria, the sister of Bernardo, the leader of the Sharks, who meet the Jets in an all-out rumble.
Well, they began it, well, they began it, and we're the ones to stop them once and for all.
Tonight, we'll have our private little mix tonight.
Ah, Anita, Bernardo's lover, whose generosity actually leads to the play's tragic ending. The role made Chita Rivera a star. Now 74, she was in Boston last spring with Chita Rivera, The Dancer's Life, and she greeted us with a generous hug.
Hi.
Hello. Oh, my turn.
We were told in the office that we were going to be talking to you. Every woman in the office turned around from their desk and spat out, "A boy like that to kill your brother."
We asked her about a moment in her new show when she recreates the experience of auditioning for West Side Story with Leonard Bernstein.
It was a big audition, you know, and so they finally get down to X amount of people. And then you've got to sing. And you're nervous because dancers then didn't sing like they do today. And so I had to sing for, and he wanted me to learn A Boy Like That, and, you know, I exaggerated a little bit in the theater, but I wasn't learning the notes. Actually, I learned that song, really, sitting next to him on the piano stool.
And in that moment, as you made clear, I mean, you were hitting some of the wrong notes, the Anita role wasn't a guarantee, and it's a very powerful statement when you go through that audition, when you tell the audience what happened.
I got the job.
A boy like that could kill your brother, forget that boy and find another, one of your own kind, stick to your own kind.
It became the right role, right time, right person, right
absolutely.
Everything.
Absolutely. You have to hope like that it is in your path. That it is your fate to be a part of whatever it is that's good for you.
You've created this iconic character. I just have always wanted to let you know. The impact on me, I refer to things as an Anita moment. If I've said something and it's not something I really meant to say, let's say I went with goodwill to someone and then they upset me and so I said the thing I didn't mean to say, like, Tony is dead, or something like that. I'll say to someone, oh, that was an Anita moment. I'm sorry.
That's funny. But that's great. I love that.
He'll murder your love. He murdered mine. Just wait and see. Just wait, Maria. Just wait and see.
You created the role of Anita, and yet Rita Moreno got the film part.
Right.
And you're very honest on stage that you wanted to kill her.
Well, the truth of the matter is, I am so grateful that it didn't happen. Because I wouldn't have done Bye Bye Birdie. I wouldn't have met Dick Van Dyke and worked with him. And I guess I was destined to really stay in the theater.
Are you aware of what happens when you're on stage in the theater when those notes strike out, the first notes of West Side Story? Can you feel what happens in the audience?
Yeah, I can. Absolutely. When it happens, you hope before that it's going to happen. And when it does, it's like a wonderful cushion. It's like a wonderful, a warm feeling all over you that you share with those people who remember. But then there's the other thing. If someone, you teach, you introduce, you know. And so when there are younger people who maybe never saw it, the thing that I am positive of is that it's brilliant.
Actress Chita Rivera, who originated the role of Anita in West Side Story 50 years ago today. Well, after a break, the things that are lost are now in Found magazine. Back in a minute, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
And then this little post-it that came from D.C. Odessi, I like you. But don't get offended, because you ain't got to like me back. But all I'm asking for is a little courtesy and my $2.20. Peace out.
That's Davey Rothbart, the founder of Found Magazine and website, reading at the Burin in Somerville, Massachusetts, from things he and others just found.
I, Becca McNeil, state herein that upon my death, Drew Copel has all legal rights to my skull.
Then there's old love letters, want ads, to-do lists, birthday cards, life's flotsam and jetsam.
From Cleveland, Ohio, Grandpa smells like poopy.
Davey is also a contributor to Public Radio's This American Life. You might have heard his stories about growing up with a deaf mother. He and his Found collaborator and brother Peter are now touring cities across the U.S. performing some of the Found material. Tonight he'll be with Dave Eggers at a benefit for 826 Boston. That's a program to teach writing to kids. And he joins us now from WIPR in Baltimore. Davey Rothbart, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
We understand that this all started on a snowy night in Chicago when you found a note on your windshield meant for Mario.
Well, yeah. You know, I came out to my car, and my name's Davey, and this note is addressed to Mario. So I opened to read it. It says, Mario, I hate you. You said you had to work. Then why is your car here at her place? You're a liar. I hate you. I hate you. Signed, Amber. P.S. Page me later. And it just struck me, you know, as so funny, you know, these complicated emotions. She's so angry and upset with him, but of course still hopeful and in love. So I started showing this note to all my friends, and they started showing me all this interesting stuff that they had found on the street. And it seemed like it'd be a cool thing to make a magazine where everyone could share what they were finding with everybody else.
And now, I mean, several issues later, it's just amazing what you found. I'm looking at one note. It's an issue number 4. It looks like it was torn out of a loose leaf binder. Somebody's written on it. Ray is out of town, so anyone can sit on this couch until Friday.
Ray's couch.
In fact, it has a title, Ray's Turf. You sort of treat these like art.
Yeah, it's just like a painting that someone painted or a poem that somebody wrote. I ask people when they send in their finds to name their find, like they would a piece of art, and also to write a couple lines of interpretation or response, you know, whatever their initial reaction is to it.
Well, you have people send in marriage proposals and all sorts of things they find. And most of the time when you see them in the magazine sort of set out like decoupage, they look like they've been crumpled up and maybe thrown away and then smoothed out. So people are throwing away these deep emotions.
And that's part of the mystery or the riddle of each of these finds is, why did I find this note all ripped up in the middle of the street? Did the person that received it, you know, they didn't like what it said and they ripped it up, threw it away? Or maybe the person that wrote it ripped it up before they even sent it to them.
Yeah. Is there a little bit of a class issue? Do we have a whiff of that? Because a lot of the words are misspelled.
There are a lot of notes that, you know, have bad grammar, bad spelling. I do want to make sure that Found Magazine doesn't become a thing where educated people are just sort of mocking, you know, looking at and laughing at people who are less educated.
We were thinking, well, gee, is there a chance that, you know, quote-unquote educated people are doing more of this kind of note leaving through email?
You know, what's interesting is that as the technology is changing, you know, people are finding stuff like emails printed out at a computer center and left behind on the printers, you know, or in a recycling bin. You know, what Found Magazine is all about is getting this glimpse of other people's lives. Yeah. I think the least interesting way to look at this found stuff would be just to laugh at the person and say, oh, you know, what an idiot. Because for me, there's not one note in Found Magazine or the Found books that I can't relate to in some way.
Do you ever hear from people whose found stuff gets found by your magazine? I mean, who are they?
It's happened a few times that someone has gotten in touch and said, hey, that's mine. But the few times it's happened, they were really cool about it. Recently, this kid emailed us, Lee M. Soprenik, and we had published this business card, Lee M. Soprenik, single freshman, and a cell phone number in Florida. So this email came in, Lee M. Soprenik, and he was like, yo, this is Lee M. Soprenik. I think you published my business card, like in one of your magazines. I'm not mad or anything. In fact, I've been getting hundreds of calls from girls all around the country, and now I'm a national pimp. So it was pretty funny. So many of them are really funny and just make me laugh out loud, but there are a lot of them that are just poignant. And every once in a while, I'm opening up all the incredible finds that people have sent in, and I'll see one, and you know, I'll just start crying. And it's maybe not that that note in particular was so acutely sad, but it's almost like the accumulated weight of all of this grief in all these letters, because you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, clearly want something so bad, and you can tell they're not going to get it, and maybe they haven't even realized it yet. It's just something so powerful about that. It makes me feel a little more connected to everybody out there.
Do you have an example of one you can look up?
Yes. So this is one that was found in Chicago. It's just a kid writing to his mom, and he says, "Dear Mom, I miss you. I really wish you were here. There's been a lot of bad stuff in my life, but I'm sure you already know that. But there's also been some really good things. Guess what's the best part of all? There's a girl. Her name is Jenna. We've been dating for about a month and a half now. I love her so much. I know if you were here, you would like her a lot. She's changed my life in so many ways. She's there for me. She's someone who actually cares about me. Remember when I was suicidal? Well, not anymore. I wouldn't even think about it. I love her more than she can imagine. I've never felt this way about anyone. I would die for this girl, Mom. Well, I got my license this summer, so I can be out here every day. So yeah, I got to go. I love you so much, Mom. I'll write you again. Bye. Your son, Colin. P.S. Trevor misses you too." And the woman that found it, she was at a cemetery. In the middle of the place was like this big old oak tree, and she saw, caught up in the highest branches, was a balloon with a ribbon coming down, and tied to the ribbon was a piece of paper. So she scaled all the way up the tree to pull down the note. And of course, it was this note here. So, you know, you can picture this kid like going to visit his mom at the cemetery, you know, and writing her this note and setting it up to her in a balloon. And for me, it's just ones like this one that move and affect me so much, you know, that make me want to pick up every piece of paper I see floating down the street. One of my favorite notes from the new issue, Found Magazine number 5, is this letter this guy has written to a girl who works in a coffee shop. And he just tells her that he's been in love with her for 10 years. He's never had the guts to tell her. And he's been through some hard times dealing with drug abuse. He ended up marrying another girl, had a kid, then they broke up. But now he's finally decided that this is the time to come clean. He needs to tell her how much he has always loved her. And then, of course, this letter that he's written her was found by someone in a sealed envelope, just, you know, her name, Trisha, on it, and sent in to us. So Trisha never even saw this letter. You know, and the guy says that he sort of now realized his life mission is to build and race the fastest Nissans in the Northwest. So my brother wrote a song called "The Baddest Nissans in the Northwest," based on this letter, and I think it's just beautiful.
Perhaps it's best Trisha did not get that letter.
Who knows? Was it because, you know, he decided at the end not to share his feelings with her? We'll never know.
Do you ever worry about, gee, what might I unleash by putting this jottings that are so private and intimate?
Yeah, and the letters are, you know, they're very personal and very raw and intimate. And you're catching someone at their most unselfconscious. So I try to be so careful. And if there's any note that seems like it could potentially be embarrassing or, you know, put someone in an awkward spot, I'm so careful to change the names and the phone numbers, you know, to keep it anonymous. At the same time, you know, we've had 5 issues of the magazine and 2 found books, and you know, we put a new find of the day up every day on the Found website. And in 6 years, you know, nobody has ever gotten in touch that, you know, was upset about their find being out there.
That's Davey Rothbart, creator of Found Magazine, author, by the way, of The Lone Surfer of Montana, Kansas. It's a collection of stories. Let's exit with a little of the music from his brother, Pete Rothbart. For more on the Rothbarts, on Found, or the 826 America program, that's where they're going to be appearing tonight in Boston, go to our website, here-now.org. Davey, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
My pursuit of the perfect time and words would keep me away.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.